Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. A crisp, chilly, glorious night here in the desert. Hope you're safe and warm wherever you're listening. Tonight, we discuss connections, circles, loops, cause and effect, continuity, the ties that bind, the links of between our past, present, and future, the concepts of time, immortality, and the really big questions, the biggest, in fact. Why are we here? What comes next? Those questions are sort of central to our existence. They've influenced our history, the rise and fall of civilizations. They've sparked wars and suffering and religion and great works of art and literature. They've led to the prevailing religious paradigms throughout the world. They're at the heart of all that we do and all that we aspire to do. In this hour, the return of Dr. Raymond Moody, the scientist, author, and lecturer who coined the term near-death experiences to describe strange but seemingly universal accounts of people who die but come back after a journey to somewhere else. Are these a glimpse of what comes next, a peek at heaven, or some sort of easily explained chemical reactions caused by dying brains? Dr. Moody clearly believes something profound occurs during these experiences and has done some amazing work documenting incidents and cases which make them very difficult to explain away, though many have tried. Dr. Moody's accumulated new and amazing case studies, including some shared NDEs. I think we touched on those the last time I interviewed him on this program, in which more than one person recounts the same bizarre experience out of body. And we'll be hearing some of those coming up in a few minutes. Then in the second half tonight, we will explore other seeming connections between our inner selves and a much bigger universe and reality. Ever have a premonition, something you knew was going to happen and then it did? Was it precognition, a glimpse of your future, or just a lucky guess, or a mere coincidence? Or is it possible that the place that we think of as our future has already happened? It's already there. The time itself is not linear after all, that tomorrow doesn't necessarily follow today, and reactions don't always happen after actions. Eric Wargo is an anthropologist and a science writer who's put together a mind-bending look at precognition and retrocausation, that is, how things that will happen in our future can sometimes affect our present. He calls them time loops. It's the title of his new book. Great stuff coming in the second half tonight. On this date, 1 year ago, as many of you will recall, the world of UFO research was rocked by a front-page story in the New York Times. That story revealed the existence of a secret Pentagon study of UFOs. Actually, there were two studies, maybe more. And a program that looks at cases related to encounters with unknown aerial vehicles and the U.S. military, such as the now famous Tic Tac and Gimbal videos that were released by the Pentagon with some urging and arm twisting and help from a guy who for 10 years headed that in-house study at the Pentagon. His name is Lou Elizondo. Elizondo first stepped forward in October of last year on a stage in Seattle with Tom DeLonge, and they dropped the news, but it didn't get a lot of attention. That changed when the New York Times carried the story. And as we have now learned, there wasn't just one study. There were two, at least. A second study commissioned by the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency, sponsored and authorized by then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. The contract was awarded to an organization called BASS, based here in Nevada. And the first hint that BASS existed came on this program. It's September 2008, if any of you might remember that. That was a week after the contract with the DIA was signed. As we now know, over a three-year period, that study collected a huge database of UFO cases and evidence and produced dozens of scientific papers. Most of that information has never been made public. And the contract, as we now know, was killed. The program ended. Lou Elizondo says the quiet study, the one inside the Pentagon, continues. Maybe there's more than one. ATIP is the name we now know, but maybe there are other smaller studies and other names. That story in the New York Times was prompted by the To the Stars Academy, Tom DeLonge's group, which is where Lou Elizondo now works. This week, I wrote a story based on an interview with Elizondo in which he dropped some pretty broad hints about what might be coming next. Last weekend, you know, I was in Phoenix at the invitation of the excellent MUFON group there, gave a little presentation. Thanks again for the hospitality, Arizona MUFON folks, as always. And while I was there, people were asking what might be coming next. And I predicted that 2019 will be a pretty big year, building on all the work that's already been done, all the pieces of the puzzle put into place, and building also on this tsunami of media coverage that finally seems to have captured the attention of some of the power players in Washington. You know what? I have no business making that kind of prediction. There are some big things happening behind the scenes. There is legitimate interest in figuring out this UFO mystery, how we can do a better job of getting our heads around it. And Elizondo seems to think that big things are coming as well. And you can see that in this story and the interview that we posted online. But to be completely frank, it's very difficult to make accurate predictions like this because there are so many variables, so many moving pieces. If you are hoping, as I am, that maybe Congress will authorize a new ongoing study, something that's well-funded, something that the public will be allowed to know about, we'll be able to see what they find. Well, who knows if that's where it's going to end up? Congress has a hard time even passing spending bills to keep the government open, and few, if any, regular bills pass anymore. I mean, the partisan divide is so strong there. So starting a new program, getting it authorized, officially, on the budget, on the record, is a tall order the way things are. At a minimum, I think what started a year ago today really has moved the ball down the field. There really is official interest among congressional staff and elected officials, and I think it's going to be tough to stuff that genie back into the bottle. So while we are all impatient, and we want it all, and we want it right now, I think that's not likely to happen. I hope 2019 really is a big year where genuine progress is made, but I'm not a psychic, so hoping is about the best I can do. If you want to see the interview we had with Lou Elizondo, we posted it on the Coast to Coast website. It's embedded in a news report that aired here in Las Vegas. You can see the story and then the raw interview, and you can try to read between the lines of what Elizondo is saying here and predicting. Now, he can't spill all the beans in direct language, and I think you can understand why, because it's pretty sensitive stuff, and it's still in the works, but he says a lot if you watch it. We also posted an excellent link of all the news stories from around the world that came out since this day last October. It was compiled by our friend and a former guest on this program, Giuliano Markovich, and it's a great resource for anyone who wants to see how this ongoing story sort of unfolded around the world through various media. Also there on the site, another story that aired here in Las Vegas about the premiere of the Bob Lazar movie. Some of you might have heard the program we did last month with Bob Lazar and Jeremy Corbell. This premiere was one heck of a gathering, and thanks to all of you who came out for it. And as we've learned, the film continues to do pretty well. Our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and I have culled other news items and oddities from various media sources around the world. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast website. Included in tonight's links is a story directly related to our first guest tonight. It's about Buddhist meditators and their proclaimed abilities to initiate something akin to a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience. I'll ask Ray Moody about this as well. And there's an update on mysterious animal mutilations, mostly involving cattle, which continue to baffle investigators, along with an article about the Alaska Triangle, a geographic area where an inordinate number of people have vanished without a trace. That and more in Naps News. While you're on the Coast website, check out How to Become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. You get access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen as often as you want on just about any device. Plus, you can subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which covers many of the same subjects as this broadcast. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog, the cat, the chicken, the pet iguana, put on a pot of Joe, slide out of those clothes and into something warm and comfy, including the bunny slippers, plop down in the Barca lounger, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Dr. Raymond Moody, A New Understanding of Near-Death Experiences. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Why are we here? What's our purpose? What comes next? Do we simply die and that's it? Is that all there is? These are central questions of the human existence. They're the reason they've inspired religions, they've sparked wars, inspired civilizations and masterpieces of art and literature. But are we any closer to understanding them centuries after they first popped into our heads? The experiences of millions of people around the world, what have been called near-death experiences, may provide a glimpse into what comes next and why we're here. The man who created that term, NDEs, joins me now to talk about the state of his research, Dr. Raymond Moody. Welcome back, Dr. Moody. Appreciate it.
Thank you, George. It's really great to hear your voice.
And yours. Been a long time.
It has been, George. It's really nice to talk with you.
You started down this road in the 1960s, and as you write in your latest book, The Light Beyond, you were not a believer. You thought, as most scientists did then and probably still do now, that we die and that's it. Can you share the story of how you started to change your mind on this and what set you on this road?
Well, as you say, I did not come from a religious family. And when I was a kid, my dad, having been a medic in World War II in the Pacific Theater, I gather retrospectively, was kind of cynical about religion. And that's how I grew up. My interest was astronomy, and which I got interested in about age of 7 or 8. And so I went to the University of Virginia in 1962 at the age of 18, planning to go on and get my PhD in astronomy, but I quickly got sidetracked into philosophy. And just in the first few days of college, I was reading Plato's Republic, which is about a near-death experience. It sort of culminates in this amazing story at the end. And I was just curious about that, because to me, the idea of life after death, I thought when I went to college that it was just a joke. My only exposure to it had been in the cartoons and my dad's New Yorker magazine he subscribed to. And I thought it was just something people made as a joke. But I remember very clearly reading in Plato, who quickly became my hero and still is, here at the age of 74, that he took that seriously. So I asked my professor, Lewis Hammond was his name, about this, and he said that these early Greek philosophers studied cases of people who had apparently died but revived. And so even at that time, though I just assumed it was some ancient Greek thing, but in 1965, I heard from one of my professors that there in Charlottesville, Dr. George Ritchie was a psychiatry professor, and he had had such an experience. So, like many other students, I took that opportunity to listen to Dr. Ritchie talk, and I didn't really, at that hearing him talk, I knew that he was sincere, and he was a very impressive man. But I just didn't know what to make of it. And then I went on, I got my PhD in philosophy in 69, and I began to teach philosophy and quickly began to hear these from my students and as the word spread from my colleagues. And so by the time I went to medical school in 1972, I had a number of cases, and then medical school was a great opportunity to hear thousands and thousands of them. But I'll tell you the truth, George. I always knew that these people were sincere. And beginning in medical school, I knew that it wasn't anything to do with oxygen deprivation to the brain, because one of my own professors, Martha McCraney was her name, during my first year of medical school, told me about when she had been trying unsuccessfully to resuscitate her mother, that she herself had left her body, and she looked down, she saw her own body, and she saw her mother's now deceased body, And trying to get her bearings, to use her term, she became aware of her mother there with her, and she, in spirit form, she said, and she saw her mother recede into this brilliant light, and from the light, she saw relatives and friends of her mother's who had already died, who seemed to be emerging from the light, and then she saw her mom go and merge with these figures and be drawn back into that light. And then she came back to her own body. Well, obviously, she didn't have oxygen deprivation to the brain, and yet she had this same experience. And subsequent to that time, I've heard hundreds and hundreds of these shared death experiences that occur not to somebody who almost dies and is revived, but rather to somebody who is there at the bedside of the dying. And I have a lot of these both from relatives and friends who were there when somebody died, and also a lot of them from physicians who have experienced extraordinary things during their attempt to revive patients. So that's been my process on it, and as you know, I just didn't know what to think. But since you and I have talked, I've really sort of come around to the view, George, that I give up, that to my utter astonishment, there is a life after death. Now, if you ask me if I believe that, I can't tell you I do, because I don't know exactly what people mean when they say they believe something in that sense. But I gather that it's something they internalize, right? Well, I haven't internalized this. It's just that I don't know what else to say.
So it's almost been imposed on you, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, it's been kind of extruded from me. And in a case that you may know of, but if you don't, I'll put you in touch with them, is that of Jeffrey Olson. Do you know about this case?
Oh, yeah, but please share it.
Yeah, and the concurrent experience that was had by his emergency room physician, Dr. Jeffrey O'Driscoll, who during the time that, what happened was that Jeffrey was practically killed in a horrific car crash in which one of his children died and his wife was killed instantly. And, but during the surgery and during which Jeffrey had a near-death experience, this Dr. O'Driscoll saw and conversed with Jeffrey's dead wife in the hospital. So I give up, and there are others like that, but that was the. I hear a lot of these from physicians who tell me that when their patient passes away, they see something leave the body, or they may see apparitions of the dying person's relatives and friends who have died seem to come into the room to escort the person away, and so on. So I have, after a long, long process with this, I give up. I think there is an afterlife.
I had wanted to ask you this a couple years ago. There's a great film that came out, Martin Scorsese, about the life of George Harrison, the Beatle. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the film, of course, George Harrison, a very spiritual guy, always seeking understanding of the universe and seeking to commune with God. And at the end of the film, there's an interview with his wife who was there when he passed away. And she mm-hmm. says, she describes it in general terms, but said it was a very profound experience at the moment he died. But basically, you could see it, that the room lit up, that his leaving. And I wondered how often that happens.
Well, you know, in terms of statistics, I can't tell you. But in terms of absolute numbers, I can tell you that it's very common. Many doctors are understandably reluctant to come forward with this. And I get it. But I'm happy to be there. Spokesperson in anticipation that it won't be too much longer before this will come out. I just hear more and more doctors now who are willing to come forward and say, yeah, I saw the patient leave his or her body and the room fill with light. Shared death
I'll tell you what, Dr. Moody, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to ask you about how your ideas have spread, how far they've spread within the medical community. We're talking with Dr. Raymond Moody, the man who created the term near-death experience and has probably done more research on it than anyone ever. You know, as we just heard, and we're going to get into this a little bit more, it's kind of understandable that doctors, medical professionals are a bit reluctant to be open and describe the kinds of amazing things they have seen when their patients essentially die and then come back. I mean, it's kind of like pilots who see UFOs, their reluctance to report it because, you know, no one wants to be the doctor who sees spirits and ghosts in the operating room the same way that pilots face potential repercussions if they report encounters with the unknown. But the number of doctors who've been willing to speak on or off the record with researchers like Dr. Moody is growing, and the cases they have reported are amazing. We're going to hear some of them in just a moment. Back with Dr. Raymond Moody. Raymond, you mentioned right off the bat in the interview that the course of your life sort of changed when you entered college and you read a bit of Plato, and it set you on the path that led you where you are now. Looking back, what you've learned after all these years, has it occurred to you that that was supposed to happen, that maybe you were meant to read that and to set that on this course?
You know, that's a very tempting thing to say in a way because of things that have happened in my life subsequently. For example, I'm from Porterdale, Georgia, and my mom and dad are from Porterdale, Georgia. And George Ritchie, the psychiatrist who I, first living person I heard this from in 1965, was from Richmond, Virginia. And George's experience took place at Camp Barkley, Texas in December of 1943 when he was a recruit in the Army. And so his experience had a profound effect on me, and I didn't see him all those years. Wrote my book Life After Life in 1974, was published in 75, November of 75, and around that time I was finishing medical school, January of 76, so I went back to Charlottesville, Virginia, having been gone, went to medical school in Georgia, but I went back to Charlottesville, Virginia, to do my residency in psychiatry there, and I went for my interviews and called up Dr. Ritchie, and he invited us over to dinner, and so that was the first contact I'd had with him since 1965. But the next night, I flew back to Macon, Georgia, and where my parents lived, and mentioned to my dad that the night before I had been with Dr. Ritchie, who was the first person I knew, who had this experience. So by that time, my dad had heard a tape of Dr. Ritchie's experience. And so I can tell you exactly what my dad said, because by that time I understood from my psychiatry training about what you call telegraphic speech, and that is if you hear somebody talking, sounding like they're writing a telegram, that's called telegraphic speech, and it's the sign of anxiety. So these are the words that my father said, and I remember the look on his face was startled. He said, "Huh, George Ritchie, Camp Barkley, Texas, December 1943. And he said, "You know, I was there, and so were you."
Man.
And my dad said that he and my mom had moved to Camp Barkley, Texas in early September 1943 so that my dad could go to officer's candidate school. And I was conceived in late September 1943, George's experience was around the 24th of December, 1943, and my mom and dad moved away from Camp Barkley on December 29th, 1943. So I was there in utero when this experience that changed my life took place. But it goes beyond that. I mean, just George Ritchie has come into my life in these most incredible ways, just out of nowhere. I mean, at very significant times in my life, and remains to this day the finest person I ever knew, George. It's, so yeah, I mean, you know, you don't want to pay too much attention to that because there's no rational way to put it together. But I have come to the, once I sort of came to this, not a logical conclusion, because logic forbids the, you know, the conclusion that there's life after death. But after I sort of was forced into this point of view, then I got to thinking, well, what is life in the first place, which you were asking earlier in the program. And where I have finally come to, and this may sound psychotic, and that's all right, because at 74 I have license to sound psychotic, but
you're among friends.
Right. But what I think is that life is story. What is your personal identity but your story, right? And Hinduism has come to this same point of view, which I, when I, a few years ago down in the Bahamas, I was lecturing at a Hindu ashram, and I was talking about this point of view, and the Swami down there told me that, yeah, this is what the Hindus think too, that basically you're here on a story and you live through a story, and then you, at the end of life, you go through some incomprehensible transformation, and then you come back and on another story. So that's how I think it works, but at the same time I realized that we really don't have the mental equipment in this state of consciousness that we're in now to figure out how this works. But that's my best guess, that the stories interrelate in a very interesting way, because to me one of them, I think probably the most interesting aspect of the near-death experience is this life review that people have, in which they say that at a certain point in their experience, everything else sort of disappears, and they're surrounded by a sort of holographic panorama, which consists of everything they've ever done, and that time stands still, there is no time, but that you see in a kind of mirror chamber everything you've ever done. But when you review it, you don't review it through the eyes and feelings you had when you were doing the action. Rather, your consciousness is displaced, and you are empathically identified with the person or people you with whom you interacted. So in the review, when you see yourself doing an unkind or, you know, action to somebody else, then in the review, you are that person, and you feel directly the hurt you brought about in the person. Or if you see yourself doing a kind-hearted action, then you are the person, and you get the good feelings. And so what that means, if you think about it, George, and, you know, it's, we can't make the logical inference that there is life after death, but we can make a startling logical inference from these life reviews. And which is amazing if you think about it. And this is a certainty. And that is, at least for some of us, life is a two-phase process, right? You live it forward as the actor or protagonist. Then time stands still, and you do a, it's like a 180-degree turnaround. and you review the same action through the eyes and feelings of the other characters. And that, to me, is enough to give us a lot of, you know, some thinking. This is a thought-provoking fact, if you ask me.
I'm not sure I'd look forward to a highly detailed review of my entire life and how it's affected other people. Oh, my gosh, that would be kind of depressing.
I'm going to try to recuse myself. but that same kind of anxiety you feel, let me increase it tenfold. Because in the shared death experiences where the bystanders say that they, that they have an experience in the while somebody else is dying, I have lots of cases, George, in which the bystander empathically co-lived the life review of the person.
Yeah, so somebody dies, the consciousness leaves the body, and the people around them sitting in, say, the surgical or operation room, they get sucked into it as well. Can you give us one that jumps out of your mind?
Well, the most amazing one to me remains this woman I met in Carrollton, Georgia, in about late 80s or early 90s, say 88 or 89. And
I know Carrollton well. I went to school there.
Oh, you did? Oh, wow, yeah. That's great. I was a professor of psychology there. And so, basically, this woman had one of these marriages we call a Sturge marriage, where it's, you know, we hear about the Greeks say there's three forms of love where we have one word, but that's not correct, actually. The Greeks have four terms for it, and one of them is Sturge, which is the kind of love that arises between two people, for example, who are a boy and a girl who are on adjacent farms in a rural area, and they grow up as playmates, and they naturally sort of evolve into a marriage. And these marriages are the bond between people in this circumstance is so profound that it's a really difficult thing in grief therapy when you have a case like this, because it's just very difficult for the person who's left behind to accommodate. But this woman had literally grown up as a neighbor of her husband, but he developed lung cancer, a very particularly ravenous type, and he died very quickly. But she was there in the hospital room as he was dying, and she said his whole life sprang up as a sort of hologram around them, and that they were able to talk back and forth as he was dying about these scenes. And quite a while I thought, well, you know, that surely this is limited to people who were close to the person who was dying. But a few years ago, I heard a case that was not like that. It was a physician contacted me who was called to the ER to resuscitate a patient. He had never laid eyes on this guy, but he said as he was resuscitating the man, these images that were plainly the memories or the, you know, the events of this man's life just sprang up around him. And I mean, I'm horrified by the idea of having to sit in on my own life review, much, much less the idea that there could be a spectator there, you know, like pass the popcorn and so on.
No. There's several scenes that need to be deleted.
That's right.
You know, I see you all over the place, Raymond. I see you all online all over the place as if you've been reborn. I mean, you've never exactly been a slacker, but I see you on your own site, the Life After Life Institute, also something called University of Heaven, where you collaborate with other medical professionals. It's encouraging to see physicians and others who are willing to use their name and tell the stories that they're hearing from their patients. And I just wonder if it is spreading, if there's any empirical indication that a lot of professionals are in fact taking it seriously.
Yes, there really is, George. And thank you for mentioning the, we call it, it's theuniversityofheaven.com. And what we, this is with my friend Lisa Smart, and we've decided that this is a very important kind of information. And as you, we both know, there's a lot of unreliable information. So we've started the universityofheaven.com to bring very fascinating cases of near-death experiences and physicians who have studied near-death experiences to bring some really serious discussions. And so please look at the website. We're trying to get folks, 'cause, and also, you know, we have to charge something to keep the thing going. But knowing, as you and I both do, that people who are interested in this are not necessarily the richest people in the world, we've priced it very reasonably so that we have these really phenomenal programs on, thus far, physicians who've had near-death experiences, but or who studied them. But soon we're going to start interviewing people with near-death experiences too. So join us, and because I do think, George, that there's a flexion point has occurred. A book that I want to recommend to you and to everybody is it's edited by Dr. John Hagan, Hagan, who I believe is the president of the Medical Society of Missouri, or at least he's the editor of the Missouri Medicine, which is one of the best medical journals in the country. And some years ago, they did a series in Missouri Medicine on of articles by physicians who have either had near-death experiences or who have studied them. And this is now published in a really terrific book called The Science of Near-Death Experiences, published by the University of Missouri Press. So there you can see some really reliable information by doctors who've studied this and some phenomenal cases of,
Well, we might have to have Dr. Hagen on the program sometime.
Oh
That
my
sounds
gosh,
pretty good.
he's a really great guy. Please do. Yeah.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Raymond Moody. When we come back, Dr. Moody, I want to get into some specific cases involving children, because I think the meaning that comes out of the NDEs involving kids is pretty profound.